So good morning and welcome back to the last day of our presentation of tenets course. Today we're going to be looking at, of course, the Prasangika school within the Madhyamika philosophical system. And as also with the Chittamatra system, they both, of course, reject the lower schools who assert that there is an independent external reality, and both Chittamatra and the Madhyamika really put the emphasis on the mind. And here in the Madhyamika, of course, nothing exists independent of the mind. And so, like yesterday, we'll start with a meditation, and again we'll emphasize the mind, or in this case particularly the awareness, and just starting to connect with mind itself in terms of resting in awareness itself. So we'll do that awareness of awareness practice we did yesterday again. And also, as we do every morning, then at the end, setting a good motivation for the day. So let's start with that. So finding a nice comfortable posture. The back nice and straight. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to rest in the stillness of the present moment, through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Now allowing your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, keeping the eyes soft and relaxed. Now bring your attention to your own mind. Releasing all appearances. Not paying attention to any appearance. Simply resting in the experience of awareness itself. Without really doing anything at all, without even trying to meditate, just be. Be aware. Be aware of being aware. find yourself with any tension, agitation, or getting caught up in any appearances, then use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax and release any appearances. Completely relaxing. Being open and spacious. Or if you're finding yourself sliding into dullness or simply being spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus, being aware of being aware. If you're still finding yourself agitated or tense, you can also lower your gaze, and this will help. Or if you're dull and spaced out, raise your gaze, and this can help as well. Now, in the last few minutes of this meditation, think about your motivation for coming here today. And try to generate the best possible motivation you can. And again, if possible, include others in your motivation. That you're not just attending for your own benefit, but you're attending so that you can benefit others in your own unique way. So again, before we launch into the explanation of the Prasangika system, let's start with a review. So again, we can use the four Buddhist attendance systems chart as a basis for that. And we saw initially that these four Buddhist tenet systems are coming from the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma that the Buddha taught. That the first turning of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths, of course, the very first teaching he gave, and also really the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. From these teachings, we have the first two philosophical schools of Vaibhashika and Sautrantika evolving. Initially, of course, in the centuries after the time of the Buddha, the Vaibhashika system started to really be developed, and we saw these various 18 sub-schools there. And then it was only at a later time, initially in the 4th century, and then again in the 7th century, that we have the two sub-schools of Sautrantika being developing through the efforts of Vasubandhu and Dharmakirti. And what we see in these two philosophical systems, of course, based on the Four Noble Truths teachings, is that in these two systems, the fundamental problem, the reason we're stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara, the fundamental ignorance is an ignorance with respect to how we see ourselves as a person. That we grasp onto ourselves as being this self-sufficient, substantially existent self. And that because of that, we have the mental afflictions arising, and then that leads to all of our suffering. So in both of these philosophical systems, they identify this as the fundamental ignorance. And so then in the wisdom practice, which is sometimes called, of course, Vipassana practice, then we are coming to realize no self. Of course, no Buddhist philosophical system says there's no me or no person. But if we can realize we do not exist in this self-sufficient, substantial way, we can overcome all mental afflictions and suffering. We can achieve liberation. And both of these philosophical systems assert this. And both of them thereby accept the fact that the world does exist as it appears to us. There is an independent, objective world there. So there's no problem with how we see the world. And in all of these philosophical systems, of course, they talk about life after life in this cycle of samsara. And they all talk about this idea of karma, that we do an action and then later we experience a result. So to be able to support both of those ideas, then each one of these philosophical systems has to posit what is that continuity that sort of goes from life to life and is the carrier of those these karmic imprints. And so we see that each of the philosophical systems posits what's called illustration of person. And there are various different assertions, continuum of the aggregates, mental consciousness, this what's called mind basis of all. And as we're going to see a little bit later, the Prasangika assertion is this mere I. So this is what the illustration of person is referring to. What is that continuity that enables this transition from life to life and also enables this experiencing of results of actions earlier created. So we looked, of course, rather extensively in those first two philosophical systems last weekend. And this weekend we're looking at the second two philosophical systems, Chittamatra and Majjhimika. And so the Chittamatra, the Majjhimika system, which we're now looking at, came from the second turning of the wheel without characteristics. And the Chittamatra system came from fine discrimination, the third turning of the wheel. In both of those turnings of the wheel, the Buddha identified a deeper level of ignorance than merely grasping onto a self-sufficient self. In both of those, turning is the will, and both of those, therefore, in those two philosophical systems, then they all say that the world does not exist as it appears. In fact, there is no independent, objective, external world there. The Chittamatrans, of course, the mind only, based on the third turning of the wheel, refute that and go on to assert thereby that there actually is no external world whatsoever, that the world is internal to the mind. Whereas the Majjhimikas refute a truly existent external world, so there is still an external world, but it's not independent, it's not truly existent. So they come to two different conclusions in how the world does exist, even though it doesn't exist as it appears. And so initially then, of course, this weekend we looked at the Chittamatra system. And as we just said, for the Chittamatrans, the deepest level of ignorance we suffer from is this grasping onto things being external to the mind. So in both the Chittamatra and Madhyamika system, what we've seen or are seeing is they talk about what's called the two obscurations. That in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, since there's just the one fundamental ignorance of grasping onto self or person, then they only talk about what's called afflictive obscurations. That if we get rid of this ignorance and all the mental afflictions, we can be liberated. Whereas in both the Chittamatra and Majjhimika system, they talk about what's called the cognitive obscurations as well. So for both Chittamatra and Majjhimika system, there's a very clear distinction between the goal of nirvana and the goal of enlightenment. So in nirvana, we become an arhat, and the goal of enlightenment is a Buddha. So for both of these systems, they say that, like the lower systems, if we want to become an arhat, if we want to be liberated from samsara, we need to eliminate the afflictive obscurations. But then if we want to move on to becoming a fully enlightened Buddha, we need to get rid of the cognitive obscurations. So even though both Chittamatra and Majjhimika talk about cognitive obscurations, of course, what they assert those are, what are the actual cognitive obscurations, differs. So what we saw in the Chittamatra was that the afflictive obscurations are the same as the two lower schools, grasping onto self-sufficient self and all the mental afflictions that come from that. And they posit the cognitive obscurations, what's stopping us then from achieving enlightenment, is this grasping onto the world being external to the mind. So if we can realize this non-duality, i.e. that there's no external world, then we can move on to achieving enlightenment. So they posit this ignorance of grasping onto an external world as the cognitive obscurations. If we eliminate that, we can achieve enlightenment. Within the Majjhimika, we saw that there are two sub-schools, Svatantrika and Prasangika. And we saw that the Majjhimika philosophical system started to evolve initially through Nagarjuna in the 2nd century. And then later in the 5th, 6th, 7th century, we have a number of Indian masters who commented on Nagarjuna. And it was due to their differences of interpretation that we have these two sub-schools being formed, Svatantrika, Prasangika. So, of course, all Majjhimikas would refute that there is a truly existent external world there. They would, unlike the Chittamatrans, who then say that actually because there's no external world whatsoever, the Majjhimikas would say that there is an external world, but it's not truly existent. It is not existing independent of the mind. But what that means, or how that's interpreted, is a little bit different in these two philosophical systems. What we saw in the Svatantrika is that they make a distinction between true existence and inherent existence, or existing from its own side. So even though the Svatantrikas reject that there is a truly existent independent world, they would say that it does inherently exist. It exists from its own side, but not independent of the mind. So for them, like the lower schools, for something to exist, it must be findable. Whereas the Prasangikas assert that true existence, inherent existence, existing from its own side, they mean the same thing. And that nothing exists from its own side. So they have a little bit different idea to Svatantrika, and that's reflected in the names. And remember, Svatantrika and Prasangika, the names come about based on how the method they use to refute a wrong view in an opponent. A Svatantra is actually what's called a syllogism. And in a syllogism, we are presenting our correct view in a very logical way to the opponent to show to them what the true position is. So in Svatantrika, this using autonomous syllogisms, we are trying to generate the correct view in the opponent based on our own position, using this reasoning, logical reasoning, to establish that our view in fact is correct. Whereas in Prasangika, a prasanga is a consequence. And so the method they use here is rather than showing to the opponent that we have the correct view using this logical reasoning of syllogisms, we operate within the opponent's view. Within their own view, we use consequences to show how their view is internally contradictory. We lead them using consequences to a point where they actually end up accepting something that originally they rejected, and thereby showing to them that actually their view is internally contradictory, and thereby they have to abandon that view and thereby come to the correct view. So this is how these names of these systems came about. But of course, that implies a subtle difference in their philosophical view, that Svatantrika accept inherent existence, whereas the Prasangika reject that. And so we saw yesterday in the Svatantrika system that there were these two sub-schools here. There were the Yogacaras and the Svatantrika. And the Yogacaras, like the Chittamatrans, reject an external world. But of course, they say that the world is internal to the mind, but unlike the Chittamatrans, they say that internal world is not truly existent, where the Chittamatrans do accept that. Whereas the Svatantrikas accept that there is an external world, but it doesn't truly exist. And so that leads us now onto the Prasangika system. And one more thing I'd like to go over a bit coming into the Prasangika is to have a look again at this idea of definitive and interpretive. That all philosophical systems, they talk about what's a definitive teaching and what's interpretive. And most of them adopt the position what can be literally accepted is definitive. So on that basis, within the lower two schools, they would say, most of them would say actually the Mahayana teachings, the teachings of the second and third turning of the wheel, are not actually even teachings of the Buddha because they're not literally acceptable. So for them, if it's not literally acceptable, it's not really the word of the Buddha. And so there are some differences within those two schools, what is literally acceptable. So there is some disagreement amongst them, the two schools, what actually is the teachings of the Buddha based on their view. But they would generally, most of them, is what's said in the text anyway, is that most of them would reject, in fact, the second and third turning wheel as even teachings of the Buddha. Whereas in the Chittamatra and Majjhimaka system, they also have a way of what's definitive and what's interpretive. And both of these would accept that all three turnings of the wheel are the teachings of the Buddha. But which of those are definitive and which are interpretive varies. So remember, the Chittamatra system is coming from the third turning of the wheel. So for them, the third turning of the wheel is definitive. They can literally accept it. That is really what the Buddha was saying. Whereas for them, the first and second turning of the wheel are interpretive. Whereas for Majjhimikas, the second turning of the wheel is definitive because that's where their system's coming from. And the first and third turning of the wheel is something we have to interpret. And we saw that actually in the presentation of tenets. So maybe we can read that out again on page 21 at the bottom. We're saying that the proponents of Svatantrika are similar to proponents in Chittamatra in accepting two types of sutras, Mahayana and Hinayana, and accepting two parts to sutras, definitive and interpretive. However, they are not similar in the illustrations of these because the proponents of Chittamatra accept the first two turnings of the wheel to be sutras of interpretive meaning and the third to be sutras of definitive meaning. So we just mentioned that. In this context, the first and third turnings of the wheel are sutras of interpretive meaning. So this context here, of course, is Svatantrika, while the middle turning of the wheel has both interpretive and definitive parts, because those where the qualification of ultimately is applied to object negation are accepted as sutras of definitive meaning, and those where middle turning wheel, where such is not applied, is accepted to be sutras of interpretive meaning. So for Svatantrika, within the second turning of the wheel, there are sutras such as the Heart Sutra, one very famous sutra, which literally says there is no form, no feeling, and so forth. And what it's saying is that there's no inherently existent form. But of course, Svatantrika accept that form exists inherently. So for them, that is interpretive, meaning that if there's not the word ultimately there, you have to interpret that actually what the Buddha meant when he said there was no form, i.e. no inherently existent form, what he meant to say was there's no inherently existent form ultimately. Then it's okay for Svatantrika. Whereas Prasangika would say that is literally acceptable. And in Prasangika, they also talk about definitive interpretive. And in our tenets text, it doesn't talk about what their assertions are. But in this tenets text, it does. So I'd like to just read briefly what it says here, just to have that clear what the Prasangika assertion is, what is definitive and what is interpretive. It says here, for Prasangika, sutras teaching the two truths are respectively those to be interpreted because they must be interpreted otherwise, and the definitive because of the mode of subsistence is definitive there. So what they're saying here in the tenets text is any sutra that teaches conventional truth is interpretive, and anything that teaches ultimate truth, i.e. emptiness, is definitive. And it says here, there are two ways of interpretation when even the literal meaning is not suitable, and when the literal meaning, though established, is not the final mode of existence. So what he's saying there is that anything that teaches conventional truth is interpreted because that's not the final way of things existing. And even sutras that talk about emptiness, but it's not emptiness of inherent existence, also need to be interpreted, i.e. From the third turning of the wheel, and also selfness as a person, self-sufficient, substantial existence. That needs to be interpreted. This is on page 236. And it goes on to say, the first and last wheels require interpretation. The middle are definitive sutras. So again, with the Prasangika, with the three turnings of the wheel, the first two are interpretive, the middle is definitive. But even within that, anything that teaches conventional truth, of course, is interpretive, and that which teaches ultimate truth, i.e. emptiness of inherent existence, is definitive. So that's a little bit the Prasangika way of looking at interpretive and definitive. So based on that, now let's go into the Prasangika system. So we're on page 22. Actually, any last questions about Chittamatra or Svatantrika before we launch in? Anything still?
The odd niggling point.
Ah, but is there anything that you want to bring up? I mean, we're going to refer back a little bit on the, based on Prasangika view today, but if there's anything now that is completely confusing or you'd like clarified, then now's the time. Yeah, so that's the Chittamatrams. We saw that a little bit in the... if we go back to page... page 15, near the top, the third paragraph, it says, this is the Chittamatra section, the five sense objects, forms and so forth, are produced on the basis of a substance that is an inner consciousness in dependence upon the latencies of common and uncommon actions deposited upon the mind basis of all. So what we saw there was, what that meant was that form, here we use the example of cup, is produced in dependence upon an inner substance, a substance inner consciousness is an imprint deposited on not mind basis of all. So that imprint ripens simultaneously as the object and the subject that is apprehending that object. So they arise simultaneously. Whereas, of course, any of these philosophical systems which assert that things are external, so Vaibhashika, Svatantrika, and Madhyamika, except for the Yogacara Madhyamikas, all of those say that the object is a condition for the consciousness to arise. That because the object is external, that is a condition for a consciousness then to arise apprehending that. So they are in a cause and effect relationship. Whereas in Chittamatra, they arise simultaneously. Right. So that's a little bit different to this.
Okay.
Right. So what this is saying is that the object and the subject, or the subject apprehending that object, arise from the same imprint. What that is saying, and this is coming really from Prasangika basis, is, as we're going to see, is that ultimate truth, how things exist, is they're empty of inherent existence. They do not exist from their own side. They're not findable. All lower schools, including Svatantrika, say things must be findable for them to exist. So, therefore, it's a little bit of a poetic way of saying that things arise out of emptiness. So when we say that, it's not like this. No, because emptiness is not a thing. This is a thing. This is a thing that is ripening. Emptiness is not a thing. So when we hear that things arise out of emptiness, we have to understand that's a little bit poetic. So, because if we sort of look at that, we could get the idea, oh, there's a thing called emptiness, and our mind is coming from that.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening.
And also, what decides that the mind, what is it that's deciding the form that arises out of emptiness?
Again,
my mind appears in the form of.
Again.
So what is deciding that that is?
Yeah. Again. Things are not created from emptiness. They're not. it's a poetic way of speaking. And what it means when we say that things arise out of emptiness, it means they're not existing from their own side. It means because of emptiness, things can appear. That's what it means. What that means, we're going to hopefully look at later today. Yeah. But it doesn't mean there's a thing called emptiness and things come out of that. Literally, no, it doesn't mean that at all. But that way of expressing is to understand that things are not existing from their own side. They're not inherently existent. Well, see, the thing is that when we talk about emptiness, emptiness, as we see, is a mere negation. It's what's called non-affirming negative. So it's and emptiness itself, the realization of that is a completely non-conceptual experience. Non-dualistic experience. So to even talk about emptiness using language is difficult. It's difficult. And so that's why these sorts of ways of speaking are sort of more poetic, to help us understand what emptiness is really, what the underlying meaning of emptiness is. So we have to understand that. Otherwise, we get this idea and then we get very confused. We end up what's called reifying or grasping onto emptiness as the only real thing. But as we understand, and that's coming up shortly, emptiness is also empty of inherent existence. Emptiness does not exist from its own side. Yeah. Nothing is findable.
For the earliest fields of vibrational perception, objects are findable.
Must be. So all schools below Prasangika say that if things are not findable, they cannot exist. Prasangika says exact opposite. Prasangika says they can only exist if they're not findable. If they're findable, they can't exist. It's illogical for them.
Yeah. So my question is, for Chittamatra,
yeah,
surely the object isn't findable because
not as external, okay, but it's findable in terms of being internal to the mind. Yeah. Yeah, sure, you can't find it as an external object, they refute that, but it's still findable. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So one last thing. Chittamatras are certain that the object and subject arise simultaneously on an imprint.
Yeah.
What creates the imprint?
So when they arise, and there's a very extensive presentation of when they talk about these imprints, they talk about a number of different types. It's actually quite complex presentation they give here of the types of imprints that we can have. But if you're interested, it's in that big thick book there. There's a very extensive presentation on it. It's quite heavy going. But I think now keep it simple. But what they're saying is when that arises, of course, so is as within all the philosophical systems, In a moment, there's two things going on. There's the experience, which is a ripening, whether it ripens like this or ripens according to the other schools. There's a ripening, so we're experiencing. So all the schools would say our experience is a ripening of karmic imprints or something similar to that. And the Chittamatras say this is the mechanism for that happening. But then, of course, in that moment, then not only do we have an experience, but we then respond to that or react usually. Depending on how we react or we respond, plants new imprints. So when we see this cup, then depending on what we do in that, that would plant more imprints in the mind bases of all to have later experiences of maybe similar cups or different experiences. So that's the mechanism for the Chittamatra. And for most of the systems, except Prasangika, they have a similar explanation that when we do an action, and we're going to talk about that actually very shortly, then every action we do motivated by a mental affliction plants a karmic imprint. So Chittamatras would use that idea that when we do an action, that plants a karmic imprint in the mind basis of all for them. For the Sautrantikas and the Svartantikas, it plants the imprint in the mental consciousness. Vaibhashika, they have a different way of talking about that, which we'll come up to. And also Prasangika also accept that we do an action, we have a result, but they don't talk about karmic imprints. They see no need to introduce this idea of karmic imprints to explain how an action leads to a result. How they explain that's coming up. Right, very soon, in fact. Okay. So let's have a look at the Prasangika system. So page 22. Same as the other systems, we have the same seven outlines. So the first one, the definition. Definition of proponent of prasanga, Prasangika. Proponent of Majjhimika, who by way of asserting just other approved consequences does not accept true existence even conventionally. So like the Svartantrika, they refute true existence conventionally. And they use the method of generating a correct view in an opponent by simply working within the opponent's system and showing that they have their system is internally contradictory through these consequences and not stating syllogisms to prove their own position. And sometimes you'll see in text, even I think Nagarjuna says something like, if I have a position, then I would be at fault. But since I have no position, I have no fault. Because they only work in the systems of the others and overturn their false ideas. Now, remember, and we'll look at that right now, if we look at one of the last charts, this modes of existence chart, we see that in the Majjhimikas, both Prasangika and Svartantrika, if we look at the first of the first column there, where it says true existence, we see that for both of Svartantrika and Prasangika, they refute true existence on all levels, both conventionally and ultimately. But then what we see is that, of course, for Svartantrika, conventionally, they do accept inherent existence, existence from its own side, and existence by way of its own character. So for them, that means something other than true existence. But for Prasangika, all of these terms above there are synonymous. So when Prasangika say they reject true existence, that also means they reject inherent existence. For Svartantrika, when they say they reject true existence, for them, that means they accept inherent existence. So there's some argument there. So that's the difference between Prasangika and Svartantrika. Very simply, is Svartantrika accepts inherent existence, Prasangika rejects inherent existence. And then if we look at the divisions, we see some examples of Prasangika, Buddha Palita, Chandrakirti, Shantideva. So of course, Buddha Palita, Chandrakirti were the two Indian masters who really distinguished the Prasangika view from the Svartantrika view. And then Shantideva, very famous 8th century Indian master who was in alignment with their interpretation of Nagarjuna. And then if we look at the etymology, we see this idea of a prasanga, a consequence. It says, there is a reason why Acharya Buddha Palita is called a proponent of Prasangika. He is called such due to accepting that an inference realizing a thesis is generated in the continuum of opponent by stating just consequences. So again, simply working within the position of the opponent in the form of consequences, showing that their position is internally contradictory and thereby they have to give it up. Yeah, but we have to. Well, he does have a view, doesn't he? So it's that he doesn't have. How we can interpret that, of course, is two ways. One is that he does not have any inherently existent view, because that statement is coming after his in a section of his text where he's saying, if you're accepting inherent existence, you've got a problem. And he says, because I don't have a problem. So that's one way. And of course, the other way we can interpret that, and sometimes commentators interpret, is that to a mind that is realizing emptiness, no conventional phenomena appear. So in that sense, there's no view at that time when we're realizing emptiness. So you can also interpret it in that way. I mean, effectively, they sort of mean the same thing. But we wouldn't say that he has no view at all. Yeah. Okay. Then if we go on to the way of asserting objects, and here coming up is something which I've mentioned briefly already, but quite important in terms of how Prasangika see a particular word, the meaning of a word, and what the implications of that are. So let's have a look at that. So it says there are two types of objects, hidden objects and manifest objects. So we already, I think last weekend, looked at how usually there's a presentation of three types of objects. The manifest objects, the ones that we can perceive directly. And then the hidden objects are slightly hidden and extremely hidden. So slightly hidden are the ones that can be established to exist through inference, and the extremely hidden through scriptural authority, which is also said to be a type of inference, as we saw earlier. So if we look here, the next sentence, it says, objects that are necessarily realized in dependence on a logical reason are posited as hidden objects, and objects that can be ascertained by an ordinary person through the force of experience without depending on logical reason are posited as manifest objects. So that's similar to the lower schools. That idea. And then he gives here some illustrations of hidden objects are impermanence of sound and emptiness of sound being truly existent. So these both are initially generated, established through inference, and then through that we meditate on that and come to directly experience it. So for an ordinary person, impermanence and emptiness are hidden phenomena. They initially need to be established through inference, but then, of course, at some point where we have a direct realization of impermanence or emptiness, then for that person, those are actually manifest objects. And illustrations of manifest objects are pot and woolen cloth, so that's easy to understand. Now comes something interesting that is only Prasangika. Perceptible object and manifest object are equivalent. So here, perceptible object is a translation of Tibetan word nung sum, or Sanskrit prajaksa. And this is what we normally translate in the lower schools as direct perceiver or direct perception. So the note here says, this can also be translated as direct. For schools other than Prasangika school, this is normally translated as perception or direct perceiver, since it refers to the cognitive subject. In the Prasangika school, however, it primarily refers to the object of cognition and hence is translated here as perceptible object. So this has a very much a bearing on then when we a little bit later look about valid cognition, valid perception, the implications of this, the difference in the way they relate that word more to the object. It's more than it means a direct perceiver, it means a perceptible object. That's how they interpret that word. And that will become obvious a little bit later when we go into the valid cognition and so forth. So we're just introducing that point here. Another way of dividing objects, conventional truths and ultimate truth. So here we have the definitions for conventional truth and ultimate truth. Let's look at the definition of conventional truth first. It's an object that is found by a valid cognition analysing a conventionality. And then there's an extra bit here, and I'll tell you why that needs to be there. And with respect to which the valid cognition analysing the conventionality becomes a valid cognition analysing conventionality. So the simple definition of conventional truth is the first part. It's simply the object that is found by a valid cognition analysing a conventionality. The second part is only added to because of the mind of an enlightened being, a Buddha. Because an enlightened being can see the two truths simultaneously with one mind. So then if you left out the second bit, there'd be actually a sort of a technical fault with the definition, because the Buddha's mind that is analysing conventionality is also realising emptiness. So then it would mean that emptiness would become a conventional truth. So that's why that extra bit is added. So it's just like a little technical point. And then it says here that it is inadmissible to divide conventional truths into two, real conventional truths and unreal conventional truths, because there are no real conventional truths. The reason this comes up is that in the Svatantrika, although we didn't see that in this tenets text, but often in tenets texts for Svatantrika that are more extensive, when they talk about conventional truth in Svatantrika, they often come with the presentation, there are two types of conventional truth, real and unreal. And what they posit as real is like flower and cup and so forth. And what is unreal is like reflection of a face in a mirror and so forth. But here Prasangika sort of a little bit don't like that way of talking. Because for them, when you say something's real, for Prasangika, that sort of seems to imply it inherently exists. So Prasangikas don't like the way of saying that there's real and unreal conventional truths. Because here it says, for them, there are no real conventional truths. Because for them, that word sort of implies they inherently exist. So they don't accept that. But going on, there's some clarification. It says, this is so because if it is a conventional truth, it is necessarily not real. This is so because if it is a conventional truth, it is necessarily unreal. So unreal means falsity, meaning not existing in the way that it appears. So when we see flowers and cups and so forth, they appear to inherently exist. And for Svatantrika, that's fine. They do inherently exist. But for Prasangika, they're called falsities, because even though they appear to inherently exist, they're not inherently existent. And another way of saying this, they're unreal. But here, we're not using the word real and unreal in terms of whether it can actually function or not. So here, thereby, in the next paragraph, we clarify. It says, it is admissible to divide conventional truths into two, real and unreal, relative to the perspective of worldly consciousness. Because a form relative to the perspective of worldly consciousness is real, and a reflection of a face in a mirror being a face relative to the perspective of worldly consciousness is unreal. If it is a real relative to the perspective of worldly consciousness, it does not necessarily exist, because truly existent forms are real with respect to the worldly consciousness but do not exist. So that's what they're saying, is that okay, we can talk about real and unreal from the perspective of worldly consciousness in terms of whether it can perform a function or not, but they're not real because, in that sense, because for worldly consciousness, they accept them to be inherently or truly existent and then don't exist in that way. So again, it's just a little bit of a terminology thing here.
That's a question on a mind perceiving impermanence in objects. So it sees things as they really are subtly impermanence. It sees a thing subtly impermanent, so it perceives a conventional truth. That seems to be quite different to the ordinary mind that sees something that really exists out there, a delusion. But the two truths seems to conflate the mind that sees things as they really are conventionally and the mind that sees things not as they really are, our ordinary mind.
Sorry, you lost me in the last bit you said there.
Well, the mind that sees things as they really are, the subtle impermanence.
Yeah, so but for Prasangika, they wouldn't accept this point. For Prasangika, they would say, and that's coming up actually a little bit later, is that an ordinary being can realize subtle impermanence and still be grasping onto inherent existence. They're not equivalent. So for them, subtle impermanence is not, even though realizing subtle impermanence, of course, is more accurate than someone grasping onto permanence, for sure. But for Prasangika, that realization of subtle impermanence is not equivalent to realizing emptiness.
So, you know, the idea that impermanence and dependent arising are two aspects of exactly the same thing.
But Prasangika...
Well,
see, this is the thing, is with the lower schools, with the two, in fact, all the lower schools, including Svatantrika, there is no problem for them to have a direct realization of subtle impermanence and still be grasping onto inherent existence, because actually things do inherently exist. So for them, you can have that realization. And for the lower schools, when they talk about dependent arising, then really they're talking about causes and conditions, i.e. impermanence, as dependent arising. So for them, for something to truly exist and be a dependent arising, there's no contradiction for the lower schools. For Prasangika, there's absolutely a contradiction. Yeah. And for them, dependent arising is not merely created through causes and conditions, but the deepest level of understanding dependent arising is merely imputed. That, the fact that things are merely imputed, is not the same as realizing in subtle impermanence. That's a deeper level of realization. So that's why there's not that parallel. So yes, you're right. I mean, all the Buddhist schools talk about dependent arising, but what they really mean by dependent arising is a little bit different, particularly in Prasangika here. Yeah. Okay. So then let's look at ultimate truth. So on page 23. An ultimate truth is an object found by a valid cognition analysing the ultimate. That's the short definition, and again, we have the second part just to overcome the technical problem of an enlightened mind. So the second part is with respect to which the valid cognition analysing ultimate becomes a valid cognition analysing ultimate. So the short definition, if we exclude enlightened beings, is simply an object found by a valid cognition analysing the ultimate. So what that simply means is when we analyze how things exist, then what we come up with, that's ultimate truth. And so for Prasangika is that when we analyze the ultimate, meaning when we analyze how things exist, will come to realize that they are empty of inherent existence. So that is what is the object that is found, is that things are empty of inherent existence. So that is ultimate truth for Prasangika. And then it says here, the divisions of ultimate truths are similar to those in the context of the proponents of Chandramatra. However, in this context, it is accepted that true cessations are necessarily ultimate truths. So when we talk about divisions of ultimate truth, they are only divisions. Actually, if we look back at Chittamatra, it becomes clear. Oh, yeah, in the middle of page 14, under ultimate truth, it says, when subtle selfness as a phenomena is divided, which is, of course, ultimate truth for them, it's divided by way of the basis of emptiness. There are 20 emptinesses. So, of course, emptiness itself cannot be divided, but we can talk about divisions of emptiness in terms of the basis of emptiness. And so, of course, here in the Prasangika, actually, if we look at our coarse and subtle selflessness chart, for Prasangika, ultimate truth is the fact that things are is empty of emptiness of inherent existence, is emptiness. We can see there that there's subtle selfness of person and selfness as a phenomena, is person being empty of inherent existence versus all phenomena being empty of inherent existence. So one way of dividing emptiness in terms of the basis is into two: emptiness of person, emptiness of phenomena. And then, as we saw with the Chittamatra, we talked about 20 emptinesses, 16 emptinesses, 4 emptiness. So also here, there's a division of emptiness in terms of basis. So when it's divided into two in terms of basis, we talk about usually person and phenomena. When we talk about emptiness in four, I think there's four is something about the emptiness of impermanent things, emptiness of permanent things, and then something about self and other, I can't remember. And then in the 16, it goes into lots of descriptions about other sorts of ways of dividing up the basis of emptiness. So therefore, here, when it talks about the division of emptiness, we're talking about we can only divide it in terms of the basis of emptiness, that's all. We can't actually divide emptiness itself into different things, divisions. Okay. Any question on that? Otherwise, it's time for a morning tea break.
You have a question. Sorry, everybody. Just going back to something that niggled me in the Chittamatra about the true cessations being conventional. I can't get my mind around that.
Right. And yeah, actually, we'll. That's going to come up after the tea break.
Okay.
So we can. And this is a unique assertion, I think, for the Prasangika. And we'll try to explain it after the break. Okay? So let's have a tea break first.